For Jamison, urgent and confidential. Destroy all copies. Stop. We must have Lobengula. Stop. No risk too great, no price too high. From Jove. Reverend Codrington, I am sending out a considerable force to escort Lobengula in. Jamison stood at the fly of his tent, looking out beyond the laager to the blackened ruins of the royal kraal. I have already sent this message after the king. Jamison came back to his desk and read from his pad. Now, to stop this useless killing, you must at once come back to me at Kabulawaya. I guarantee that your life will be safe and that you will be kindly treated. Has the king sent you a reply? Clinton asked. He had declined a seat and stood stiffly in front of the camp table that served Jamison as a desk. Here, the doctor handed Clinton a grubby folded scrap of paper. Clinton scanned it swiftly. I have the honour to inform you that I have received your letter and have heard all what you have said, so I will come. This is written by a half-caste rogue named Jacobs, who has joined up with Lobengula, Clinton muttered, as he glanced through the rest of the wandering, misspelt and barely literate note. I know his handwriting. Do you think the king means it? Mungo St. John asked. Do you think he means to come in? Clinton did not turn his head towards where Mungo lolled in a canvas camp chair across the tent. Dr. Jamison, I do not condone your actions or those of your infamous chartered company, but I came here at your bidding in order to do what little I can to redress the terrible wrongs that have been perpetrated on the Matabele people. However, I draw the line at having to speak or in any way communicate with this henchman of yours. Jamison frowned irritably. Reverend, I would like you to bear in mind that I have appointed General St. John as administrator and chief magistrate of Matabele land, Clinton cut in brusquely. You are, of course, aware that your chief magistrate was once a notorious slave trader, buying and selling the black people over whom you now give him supreme powers. Yes, thank you, Reverend. I am aware that General St. John was once a legitimate trader, and I am also fully aware that while a serving officer of Her Majesty's Navy, you led an attack on his ship, an action which led to your being court-martialed, imprisoned, and cashiered from the service. Now let us continue, Reverend. If you do not wish to talk directly to General St. John, you may address me instead. In the camp chair, Mungo St. John crossed his beautifully polished riding boots and smiled lazily, but his eye was bright and sharp as a bared blade. Dr. Jamison, would you ask the good priest if he is of the opinion that Lobengula will give himself up? Would you? Clinton asked, still without a glance in St. John's direction. No, Mungo replied, and nodded his head significantly at Jamison. Reverend, General St. John is taking out a flying column to bring Lobengula in. I want you to go with him, please, Jamison said. Why me, Doctor? You speak the language fluently. So do many others. Zuga Ballantyne is one of them. He is also a soldier. Your brother-in-law has other important work to do. Stealing the king's cattle, Clinton cut in acidly. It was already common knowledge that Zuga Ballantyne had been given the task of rounding up the vast Matabele herds and bringing them into Kabulawayo for distribution. However, Jamison might not have heard the remark, and he went on smoothly. Besides, Reverend, you and your wife have been close friends of Lobengula for many years. He trusts and likes you. But since it was Major Ballantyne who delivered our ultimatum, Lobengula looks upon him as an enemy. Not without reason, Clinton murmured dryly. However, Doctor, I refuse to be your Judas goat. Your presence with the column may help to avert another bloody conflict, with the inevitable result of hundreds, if not thousands, more Matabele slaughtered. I would think it your Christian duty to try to prevent that. Clinton hesitated, and Mungo murmured. I do point out, Doctor, that after Lobengula surrenders, Reverend Codrington will be in a position to comfort and protect him, to ensure that the king is kindly treated and that no harm befalls him. I give him my word on that. Very well, Clinton capitulated sadly. On the understanding that I am to be the king's protector and adviser, I will go with your column.
They follow, Gundung said softly. They still follow.
And Lobengula lifted his face and looked at the sky. The raindrops, heavy and hard as newly minted silver shillings, struck his cheeks and forehead.
"The rain," said Loban Gula.
"Who said they could not follow us in the rain?" "It was me, my king." "But I was wrong," Gundung admitted. "When he marched from Gubulawayo, one bright eye had 300 men and 4 of the little guns with 3 legs which chatter like old women. He also had wagons and 1 big cannon."
"I know this," said the king.
"When the rains came, I thought that they had turned back. But now my scouts have come in with heavy news to tell. One bright eye has sent back 1/2 of his men and the wagons, the cannon, and 2 of the little 3-legged guns. They could not ride over the mud, but..." Gundang paused. "Do not try to spare me, my brother. Tell me it all." "He comes on with 1/2 his men and 2 little machine guns drawn by horses. They are traveling fast, even in the mud."
"How fast?" the king asked quietly.
"They are a day's march behind us. Tomorrow evening they will camp here on this very river." The king pulled the tattered old coat around his shoulders. It was cold in the rain, but he did not have the energy to crawl under the canvas of his wagon tent. He looked out across the watercourse. They were camped on the Shangani River, but almost 150 miles higher than where the first battle of the war had been fought upon the headwaters of this same river. They were in thick Mapani forest, so thick that a road had to be chopped through it to allow the king's wagons to pass. The terrain was flat and relieved only by the clay hills of the termite nests that dotted the forest, some of them as large as houses, others the size of a beer keg, just big enough to smash the axle of a wagon. The sky, grey and heavy as the belly of a pregnant sow, pressed down upon the tops of the Mapani. Soon it would rain heavily again. These fat drops were merely a warning of the next deluge to come. And that trickle of muddy water, the colour of a drunkard's bile, down the middle of the watercourses would be a roaring torrent again within minutes of the onslaught.
150 men, Gundang, the king sighed. How many have we?
2,000, said Gundang. And perhaps tomorrow or the next day Gambu may come to join us with 1,000 more.
Yet we cannot stand against them.
The men we would eat. It is those little guns with 3 legs. Oh, king, not even 10,000 warriors, each with the liver of a lion, could prevail when they begin to laugh. But if the king commands, we will run.
No. It is the gold, Loban Gula said suddenly. The white men will never let me be until they have the gold.
I will send it to them. Perhaps then they will leave me in peace. Where is Kamuza, my young Induna? He speaks the language of the white men. I will send him to them.
Kamuza came swiftly to the king's bidding. He stood attentively in the spattering rain beside the front wheel of the wagon.
Place the little bags of gold in the hands of the white men, Kamuza, my trusted Induna, and say to them thus, you have eaten up my regiments and killed my young men. You have burned my kraals and scattered the women and children of Matabili land into the hills where they burrow for roots like wild animals. You have seized my royal herds, and now you have my gold. White men, you have it all. Will you now leave me in peace to mourn my lost people?
There were 10 bags of white canvas, stamped with black lettering. They made a heavy burden for one man to carry. Kamuza knelt and tied them together in bunches, and then packed each bunch into a leather grain bag.
To hear is to obey, great elephant, Kamuza saluted his king.
Go swiftly, Kamuza, Loban Gula ordered softly, for they are close upon us.
Will Daniel sat his own horse, with the brim of his hat pulled down to protect the bowl of his clay pipe from the drizzling rain, and over his shoulders he wore a rubber ground sheet, which glistened with moisture and gave him a pregnant, clumsy look as he slumped, barrel-bellied in the saddle. On lead reins he held 2 other horses. One was a pack animal, whose burden was covered with a white canvas sheet. Daniel no longer bore the lofty rank of sergeant.
After his conduct at the secret valley of the Amlimo, Zuga Ballantyne had seen him reduced to trooper, and as an additional mortification, he was now acting as Batman to one of the officers of the flying column. The pack horse carried Captain Coventry's traps. The other horse belonged to Will's old comrade in arms, Jim Thorne. That worthy was crouched behind a thorny shrub, a short way off, with his belt hanging around his neck, and cursing bitterly in a low monotone.
"Filthy bleeding water! Stinking bloody rain! Godforsaken country!"
"Hey, Jimmo, your backside must be on fire by now. That's the 12th time today."
"Shut your ugly face, Will Daniel," Jim shouted back,
and then dropped back into his dismal monotone.
"Bloody gut-breaking trots!"
"Come on, Jim, my lad."
Will lifted the brim of his hat to peer about him.
"We can't fall too far behind the rest, not with the bush crawling with bloody black savages."
Jim Thorne came out from behind the bush, rebuckling his belt, but wincing with another bout of stomach cramps. He climbed gingerly up onto the saddle, and the three horses plodded along in the deep yellow muddy ruts of the horse-drawn carts which carried the two Maxim machine guns. The rear of the column was out of sight ahead of them amongst the dripping mapani trees. The two of them had soon learned to loiter at the back, away from the scrutiny of the officers, so that they would not be ordered into the thigh-deep mud when the Maxim carts bogged down and had to be manhandled through one of the glutinous mapani holes.
"Look out, Will!"
Jim Thorne yelled suddenly, and his oilskins flapped like the wings of a startled rooster as he tried to draw his rifle from its scabbard.
"Look out, bloody savages!"
Amatabili had stepped silently out of the thick bush alongside the cart tracks, and now he stood directly in front of the horses and held up his empty hands to show the white men that he was unarmed.
"Await, Jimmo," Will Daniel called. "Let's see what the bastard wants."
"Oh, I don't like it, man. It's a trap."
Jim searched the bush around them nervously.
"Let's shoot the black bugger and get out of it."
"I come in peace,"
the Matabili called in English. He wore only a fur kilt, without armlets and leg tassels, and the rain shone on his smoothly muscled torso. On his head was the headring of an Induna. The two mounted men both had their rifles out now and were aiming from the hip, covering Kamuza at point-blank range.
"I have a message from the king."
"Well, spit it out, then."
"Lobengula says take my gold and go back to Kabulawayo."
"Gold?" demanded Jim Thorne.
"What gold?"
Kamuza stepped back into the scrub, picked up the leather grain bag, and carried it to them. Will Daniel was laughing excitedly as he pulled out the little canvas bags. They jingled softly in his hands.
"By God, that's the sweetest music I've ever heard."
"What will you do, white men?"
Kamuza demanded.
"Will you take the gold to your chief?"
Don't fret yourself, my friend,"
Will Daniel clapped him delightedly on the shoulder.
"It'll go to the right person. You have the word of William Daniel himself on it."
Jim Thorne was unbuckling his saddlebags and stuffing the canvas sacks into it.
"Christmas and my birthday all in one," he winked at Will.
"White men, will you turn and go back to Kabulawayo now?"
Kamuza called anxiously.
"Don't worry about it another minute," Will assured him,
and ferreted a loaf of hard bread out of his own saddlebag.
"Here's a present for you, Barnseller. Present. You understand?"
Then to Jim.
"Come on, Mr. Thorne. It's Mr. I'll be calling you now that you and I are rich." "Lead on, Mr. Daniel,"
Jim grinned at him, and they spurred past Kamuza, leaving him standing in the muddy pathway with the mouldy loaf of bread in his hands. Clinton Codrington came slipping and sloshing along the bank of the Shangani River. The lowering clouds were bringing on the night prematurely, and the forests on the far bank were dank and gloomy. The thunder rumbled sullenly, as though boulders were being rolled across the roof of the sky, and for a few seconds the rain spurted down thickly and then sank once more to a fine drizzle. Clinton shivered and put up the collar of his sheepskin coat as he hurried on to where the Maxim carts stood at the head of the column. There was a tarpaulin draped between the two carts, and beneath it squatted a small group of officers. Mungo St. John looked up as Clinton approached.
"Ah, Parson,"
he greeted him. Mungo had learned that this address irritated Clinton inordinately. You took your time?
Clinton did not reply. He stood hunched in the rain, and none of the officers made room for him beneath the canvas.
Major Wilson is going to make a reconnaissance across the river with a dozen men. I want you to go with him to translate, if he meets any of the enemy.
It will be dark in less than 2 hours, Clinton pointed out stolidly.
Then you had best hurry.
The rains will break at any minute, Clinton persisted. Your forces could be split.
Parson, you bother about brimstone and salvation. Let us do the soldiering.
Mungo turned back to his officers.
Are you ready to go, Wilson?
Alan Wilson was a bluff Scot, with long dark moustaches and an accent that burred with the tang of heather and highlands.
You'll be giving me detailed orders then, sir,
he demanded stiffly. There had been ill feeling between him and St. John ever since they had left Gubulawaya.
I want you to use your common sense, man, St. John snapped. If you can catch Lobengula, then grab him, put him on a horse, and get him back here. If you are attacked, fall back immediately. If you let yourself get cut off, I will not be able to cross the river to support you with the Maxims until first light. Do you understand that?
I do, General.
Wilson touched the brim of his slouch hat.
Come on, Reverend, he said to Clinton. We do not have much time.
Burnham and Ingram, the two American scouts, led the patrol down the steep bank of the Shangani. Wilson and Clinton followed immediately behind. Clinton's lanky, stooped frame, in the scuffed sheepskin jacket and with a shapeless stained hat pulled over his ears, looked oddly out of place in the middle of the uniformed patrol of armed men. As they came level with Mungo St. John, standing on the top of the bank, with his hands clasped behind his back, Clinton bent low from the saddle of his borrowed horse and said so quietly that only Mungo heard him.
Read 2 Samuel chapter 11, verse 15.
Then Clinton straightened, gathered the old grey gelding with which he had been provided by the company, and the two of them went sliding untidily down the cutting in the steep bank, which the Matabele had dug to take Lobengula's wagons across. At this point the Shangani River was 200 yards across, and as the little patrol waded the deepest part of the channel, the muddy waters reached to their stirrup irons. They climbed the far side and almost immediately were lost from view in the dripping woods and poor light. Mungo St. John stood for many minutes, staring across the river, ignoring the fine drizzling rain. He was wondering at himself, wondering why he had sent such a puny force across the river with only hours of daylight left. The priest was right, of course. It would rain again soon. The heavens were leaden and charged with it. The Matabele were in force. The priest had seen the Inyati Impi, under its old and crafty commander, Gundang, escorting the wagons away from Gubulawaya. If he were going to reconnoitre the lie of the land beyond the river, then he knew that he should have used the last of the daylight to ford his entire force. It was the correct tactical disposition. That way the patrol could fall back under the protection of the Maxims at any time during the night. Or he could go forward to relieve them if they ran into trouble. Some demon had possessed him when he gave the orders. Perhaps Wilson had finally irritated him beyond all restraint. The man had argued with him at every opportunity, and had done his best to subvert Mungo's authority amongst the other officers who resented the fact that he was an American over British officers. It was mostly Wilson's fault that this was such an unhappy and divided little expedition. He was well rid of the overbearing and blunt Scotsman, he decided. Perhaps a night spent in company with the Inyati regiment would take some of the pepper out of him, and he would be a little more intractable in the future, if there was a future for him. Mungo turned back to the sheltering tarpaulin strung between the gun carriages. Suddenly a thought struck him, and he called down the line.
Captain Borrow?
Sir?
You have a Bible, don't you? Let me have it, will you?
Mungo's Batman had a fire going, and coffee brewing in the shelter, and he took Mungo's coat to dry and spread a grey woolen blanket over his shoulders as Mungo squatted beside the fire and paged slowly through the little leather-bound, travel-battered Bible. He found the reference and stared at it thoughtfully.
And he wrote in the letter, saying, Set ye Uriah in the forefront of the hottest battle, and retire ye from him, that he may be smitten and die.